From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Hundreds of scientists recently signed on to a document endorsing civil disobedience as the only answer to saving our atmosphere from climate change. Reuters reported that, quote, in a joint declaration, climate scientists, physicists, biologists, engineers, and others from at least 20 countries broke with the caution traditionally associated with academia to side with peaceful protesters courting arrest from Amsterdam to Melbourne. In the U.S., actress Jane Fonda announced she was moving to Washington, D.C. so she could engage in civil disobedience every Friday and get arrested until there was action on the climate. And my next guest arrived at the same conclusion, writing an op-ed in the Guardian newspaper that he would get arrested protesting inaction on climate change. We go now to the UK to speak with George Monbiot, world-renowned journalist, author and activist, and a columnist for The Guardian. His books include Out of the Wreckage, How Did We Get Into This Mess, and The Age of Consent. More than 10 years ago, George Monbiot wrote the book Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Welcome to the program, George.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
And I remember interviewing you in 2007 when that book first came out. You are one of those people who has been drawing attention to this issue for well over a decade. So what led you to writing this column in The Guardian and then getting arrested in London?
Well, I've throughout the whole of my career, really, which is now 34 years of writing and taking action on environmental crises, I feel like I've been banging my head against a brick wall until the bricks have come out. My head's all right, but the bricks have been knocked out. It's been very frustrating because I just haven't seen the traction in the media, in government, amongst people in general. And part of the problem, I think, is that there haven't been sufficiently strategic movements that have really begun to draw attention to the issue. And now I think for the first time in my life, there are. With Extinction Rebellion, with the youth climate strikes around the world, we've seen a radical change to the global conversation about climate breakdown and environmental breakdown. And I've been urging people to participate in these movements. I've been participating in them myself. And in this country, in the UK, many hundreds of people have been arrested as a result of being part of Extinction Rebellion. And so my feeling is, well, I can't urge other people to be part of this movement, many of whom then go on to get arrested, if I'm not prepared to do it myself. And arrest, in this case, we see as a very powerful tool because it shows other people that you're serious. It's easy to sit behind your computer screen, firing off articles, writing tweets, whatever it might be. And people say, well, you're just saying that. But when you show that you're prepared to put your body on the line and to jeopardize your liberty, then people take it a lot more seriously. And that's a lesson from the civil rights movement, from the democracy movements in East Germany and Poland, from the suffragettes, from many other movements throughout history. Where we the salt marches in India, for example, where other people see, oh my God, they really are serious about this. They really are committed to making change. Perhaps we should join them.
And the act of getting arrested is not an easy one. We were just rolling video of your arrest. You basically put your physical self at risk. You're carried away by cops. They might get rough with you. It's a little bit scary.
Well, it has to be said that as a white middle-class man, I'm quite protected by comparison to other people. You know, if I were black, I would be much more worried about putting myself on the line there because, you know, there's no question in the UK, there's institutional racism in the police. But because I have this privilege, I feel I ought to be using it. And, you know, the police sort of treated me fine. It was okay. And they held me for quite a while. Eventually, they put me in a police van. They drove me to the other side of London because so many people had been arrested. They didn't have room in all their stations. They put me in a cell for a few hours. And then suddenly, late at night, they let me go because they just are so overwhelmed with the number of people being arrested that they're having to get people out of the door as quickly as possible. So I'm probably going to get charged for the alleged offences under which they arrested me, but I haven't been charged yet. I've been, the phrase goes, released under investigation.
So there have been many, many others getting arrested, as you've said, and we've seen very similar photos of people being dragged away, carried away. They're engaging in civil disobedience. Here in the US, we might not be as familiar with what Extinction Rebellion has achieved in London this year alone. Just over a few months, it's been quite remarkable. And now we've come to a point where I understand the organization has been banned.
Yes, it's extraordinary. So the police have used this remarkable power under a 1986 Act where they can basically ban any protest for any length of time they choose from any area they choose. So for the time being, at least, they have banned Extinction Rebellion from the whole of London. And we see this as a profoundly illiberal law. We think it's deeply undemocratic. In human rights law all over the world, there's a right to peaceful assembly, and that right is now being denied. So as well as being arrested under that act, because that was one of the things they told me they were arresting me for, breaching Section 14 of that act, I'm also happen already to have been pursuing a court review of that act in the High Court in London. I'm one of the plaintiffs in that review, and as a result, I'm in this very interesting position of launching a legal challenge to an act that I now might be charged under.
So this is the kind of thing that you hear about happening in other countries, maybe in the global south, where there might be dictatorial regimes. And if there's a rebellion, they will simply ban the organization from protesting. Quite remarkable to see this happening in the UK. What has the response been of politicians there? I know, of course, everyone's overwhelmed with the Brexit discussions, but there was a time when some members of parliament said, after seeing Extinction Rebellion bring London to a standstill earlier this year, made some political concessions. I suppose it's not enough, though, right?
They did declare a climate emergency, which is great. You know, that, I mean, it really shows that protest works. Anyone who tells you protest doesn't work, well, you know, for a start, they know nothing about history. You know, there would be no democracy anywhere without protest. There would have been no decolonization anywhere without protest. There would be no civil rights without protests. But this is another example of protest working. The UK Parliament, having been so sluggish on this issue, declared a climate emergency directly as a result of the protests. Now, of course, declaring it and actually doing something about it are entirely different matters. And it's quite easy to declare it, although at least that gives us something to hold them to account for. But we need to see some much more radical action to prevent the greatest crisis that humankind has ever faced, which is the destruction of our life support systems.
Now, the young people who around the world have been skipping school on Fridays under the banner of Fridays for Future are in a way that action is also an act of civil disobedience, is it not? Children are basically saying, we're not going to do what we're supposed to do to protest climate inaction.
The children have really led the way. It's been so inspiring. And in fact, in this age when politicians around the world are being uniquely irresponsible, are just not taking their duties to humanity seriously, children are being uniquely responsible. They're taking responsibility in a way that I've never seen young people do before. I don't think young people have ever done so before in this way. And it's almost as if they are the adults now. And the adults supposedly leading their nations are behaving like squabbling children.
Jane Fonda here in the U.S., as I mentioned, has also taken this dramatic action. I was just with her in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, or literally standing a few feet away from her as she addressed the global climate strike protest in L.A., which, you know, as an actress, she ordinarily lives in L.A. She has moved to D.C. She just got arrested for the second Friday in a row this Friday. Her first one was last Friday. She is, you know, she's a senior citizen. She is taking the lead from children as well. I thought her action was also quite remarkable. And I'm wondering, George, if you think that high-profile people like her, like yourself, like Greta Thunberg, in taking these actions can have a real impact because others can follow in their footsteps. When you see somebody doing it, it's the best PR.
I think it does really help. I think what we're able to do is to normalize this sort of action, where this isn't just something which completely marginalized people do, but it can be something that people with a mainstream platform can do as well. And that is an important component, though. You know, it's worth remembering that people like me and people like Jane, you know, will only ever be one small piece in the jigsaw. To make anything like this work, you need thousands of people dedicating their lives to it. And that's what we're seeing. And, you know, the platform that I've got and the reason we're talking here today is because of these incredibly effective global movements. And, you know, I've always known all my life, I've known what to say and what to write, but I haven't known what to do. And finally, we got some movements that know what to do. I've got this really great strategic sense of how to run campaigns really effectively. And finally, I feel we're getting some momentum. And I feel that my words, what I say and what I do and what I write are beginning to land in a way that they haven't before. And that's entirely as a result of the movement created by other people.
Let's talk about the obstacles to saving our planet. I want to quote the Shell chief executive, Ben Van Beurden, who recently in an interview with Reuters basically said that he had no choice but to continue to invest in oil and gas. He said, despite what a lot of activists say, it is entirely legitimate to invest in oil and gas because the world demands it. We have no choice but to invest in these projects. And he, of all the oil executives of the top oil and gas companies, has actually been one of the most prominent voices advocating action on the climate. How do you respond to this?
Yeah, well, there was a paper published in the scientific journal Nature recently showing that if we're to have any reasonable chance of preventing more than 1.5 degrees of global heating, which, you know, where we really get into the very dangerous zone beyond that, then we have to start retiring existing fossil fuel investments. We can't afford any new ones at all. We can't afford any more exploration, any more development. We actually have to start shutting down existing ones and keeping fossil fuel reserves that are already being exploited, keeping them in the ground. And of course, we don't need to keep investing in new fossil fuels because we have so many alternatives which are just ready to go, but we're being locked into 20th century technologies when we should be moving into 21st century technologies. And we're not being locked in by accident. We're being locked in by people like Ben Van Beurden and his company because they are lobbying very hard to prevent that transition from taking place. And while in public, they make all these advertisements saying, we're making this incredible shift towards renewables, when you actually read their annual reports, you see that there's no such shift taking place at all. In fact, they've been saying the same thing for 20 years, we're making this shift, and there's been no evidence of that shift at all. All their major investments are still going into fossil fuels. And at the same time, they are funding this massive lobbying effort to prevent governments from forcing them to make that shift.
Incredible. Shell's operations alone contributed to so much carbon dioxide. Their output between 2017 and 2018 of carbon rose 2.5 percent. So they're not just continuing with business as usual. They're actually increasing their output of carbon at the precise moment when we need to be decreasing and stopping it. So Bill McKibben, the famed climate activist and founder of 350.org, said if Shell says that it can't stop itself from investing in 35 new oil and gas projects, we have no choice but to invest in oil, says Shell. So McKibben said, we have no choice but to try to stop them. And of course, 350.org has also been one of the leading organizations doing engaging in climate action. But what did this Shell CEO mean when he says the world demands it? How are they able to say this, that the world demands that we keep burning oil and gas?
Well, we need energy, but that energy doesn't have to be oil and gas. That energy could be renewables. That energy could be hydrogen. There are lots and lots of ways of doing this, of meeting our needs without the continued expansion of fossil fuels. In fact, we could meet our needs with far fewer fossil fuels than we use today. But because that's where their investments lie, they've sunk vast costs, trillions altogether, into fossil fuel exploitation, they want to recoup those costs. And so they're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that those investments retain their value. And that means that they can continue to exploit them for the whole life of those fields, those oil fields and those gas fields, regardless of the impact that that is going to have on humanity and the rest of life on Earth. Bill, as always, is entirely right. Our survival depends on stopping them. This isn't just a nice thing to do, or maybe we ought to stop the oil companies. We have to do that if we are to have any chances of getting through this century, let alone subsequent ones. If our children are to have a peaceful and prosperous and decent life, if we're to share this planet with all the wonders that we now know, we have to stop the oil companies.
How important is the letter signed by hundreds of scientists that civil disobedience, essentially endorsing civil disobedience in the face of climate change? You know, scientists, of course, have been the ones giving us the data that we have needed to to sound the alarm. But often they have sort of stayed on the sidelines when it came to activism, but not anymore, it seems.
There's this long-standing tradition called scientific reticence, where scientists really, you know, don't speak their minds because, well, you know, we have to be a bit cautious because we can't be completely sure of anything. And they're often overcautious. They don't want to stick their necks out. They don't want to say anything which their colleagues might regard as controversial. And as a result of that, sometimes there has been, I think, a lack of leadership. But now we're seeing something really markedly different. This is a significant step change where they've just been ignored for so long. They're like invisible people. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been making these warnings. They've been pointing out that we're heading in this direction and it's a really dangerous direction in which to go. And then people like me and Bill McKibben have been picking up their findings and saying, well, what this means is we have to do this and we have to do that. These are the actions we have to take. And this is what governments need to do. And this is what companies need to do. And this is what activists need to do. And this is what everybody needs to do. But we've all just been ignored until now. And so it's really encouraging to see these scientists coming out and possibly at some risk to their careers, who knows, saying what needs to be said. And while they might bear a cost for that, history will see that they're on the side of right.
We are right now talking at a time when about 500,000 people in the northeastern United States had their power knocked out because of a bomb cyclone. And I had never heard of such things as bomb cyclones up until about a year ago when we started to see them. So climate change is here. And I'm wondering, George, finally, if you think that the way in which the world's powerful, the ones who are supporting the continued burning of oil and gas, are going to go from denial to acceptance and to basically, you know, ignoring their role in this, because for so long they've denied that the planet was warming. Now it is warming. There's no way to deny it. And we're starting to see people just sort of accept, okay, the climate is continuing to warm, but there's nothing we can do about it. And they're washing their hands off of it. You know, don't those responsible, like the Shell CEO, need to pay a price? They have to be held criminally liable.
Well, I'm very much in favor of introducing an international law of ecocide, which would be similar to a law of genocide, where massive acts of environmental destruction are punished as the perpetrators of genocide are punished. And this wonderful lawyer who sadly died recently, Polly Higgins, had devoted her whole career to trying to develop that law of ecocide. And luckily there are now many people who have taken up her call and are carrying on that great work that she began. I think it's essential. Now, you know, I don't say that because I'm just out to get these people. Unless we hold people who commit great crimes to account, then other people commit great crimes. That's why there's a law against genocide. That's why there's a law against murder. There has to be a disincentive. And at the moment, there isn't a disincentive. They commit great crimes and they take away great fortunes as a result. Well, if they do great crimes, they should do great time. And I think these climate criminals should indeed be behind bars.
Well, George, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your columns in The Guardian from our website. Really appreciate all the work you do.
Thank you very much, Sonali. As ever, really lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. George Monbiot has been my guest. He's a world-renowned journalist, author, and activist, and a columnist for The Guardian. His books include Out of the Wreckage, How Did We Get Into This Mess, and The Age of Consent. In 2007, he wrote the book Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.